You're listening to Charlottesville's Podcasting Network with your host, Dan Gould. Virginia History with Rick Britton starts right now. Rick Britton is a local award-winning author, cartographer, and historian. You can find him online at rickbritton.com. Rick joins me in studio for the Christmas Day edition of our continuing series on Virginia's 18th and 19th century history. Good morning and Merry Christmas.
Good morning and Merry Christmas. But you also wanted to mention that we're pre-recording this, aren't we?
That is indeed the fact.
That's right.
The truth of the matter. We are actually home with our
families. With our families.
With our families on Christmas morning. Let it be known. So I see you've brought your book along with you this morning.
Yeah, I brought my most recent book. And this one, thank you for mentioning, this one's called Jefferson, a Monticello Sampler. It was written in 2007, 2008. I'd been writing about Thomas Jefferson and Monticello for a number of years for Virginia, mostly newspapers and magazines. And my articles on Jefferson had become kind of popular. So I decided to take my favorites, I actually had more, take my favorites and expand them into chapters. So what Jefferson and Monticello Sampler is a collection of 13 standalone articles about different aspects of Jefferson's life, different things that he found fascinating. So it's not a running narrative. It's not a biography of Thomas Jefferson. And I've been complimented on the way it's put together because people find, like, for example, one of the topics is Jefferson's architectural legacy. Another one is his founding of the University of Virginia. Another is Thomas Jefferson and science. Another is Jefferson and the American West. He's often called the father of the American West. People like the idea because you can of having standalone pieces, because at one sitting they can read an entire essay, an entire chapter covering this one aspect of Jefferson's life. And anybody that knows Jefferson knows that there's a lot of different things about this guy. He was interested in everything.
Yeah, I know. That's what makes him so amazing.
Yeah.
Now, are the chapters loosely based on talks that you gave, or just
No, they're based originally on newspaper and magazine articles that I wrote, and then they are greatly expanded into chapter length. So with the 13 chapters or 13 essays, it's about 220 pages long. And one thing that was really great about the book, the year after it was published in 2008, the very next year, 2009, a couple of years ago now, it was entered in a competition at Book Expo in New York City. Book Expo is the largest book convention in the United States, and the book won a bronze medal for nonfiction.
Wow!
So
congratulations.
Thanks. I was really complimented. It's been doing really well. It sells a ton up at Monticello, as you can imagine. They've got a great museum shop, they call it, but it's a gift shop and a bookshop, and it sells really well there. And if the listeners are interested, it's offered on Amazon.com. It's also available on BarnesandNoble.com. So just go up to the book section and put in my name, Rick Britton, B-R-I-T-T-O-N, and you'll come right to it.
We'll make it even easier than that, Rick. We'll put links right to the book on as part of the notes that go along with this podcast.
Oh, fantastic.
So
thanks.
You can just click, and just the next thing you'll see is a buy me button.
Well, that's great.
All right. So I understand you've brought us some stories that are suitable for Christmas Day today.
Yeah. Christmas in the Civil War. Christmas didn't shut down just because there was this horrible conflict dividing our nation. And I wanted to start off by talking about some of the imagery of Christmas, imagery that we're all familiar with. And I think the listeners will be surprised to hear that they would recognize and some of the most iconic imagery was already established, and some of it established during the Civil War. And I'm talking about, in particular, Harper's Weekly. Harper's Weekly was a newspaper, tabloid size, that was established in New York City just prior to the Civil War. By the time of the outbreak of the Civil War, 1861, they had over 200,000 subscribers. So it was one of the most popular newspapers in the United States. What was so popular about it? They ran articles by people like Charles Dickens and other popular writers of the day. Also news from the front, how the armies were doing. But what separated the weekly and other tabloid newspapers from the regular newspapers is all of the illustrations. And they had illustrations. We're talking about page size illustrations by some of the most famous illustrators of the day, people like Winslow Homer, who went on to become a famous, if not one of the most famous American painters, but also Alfred Waad, who traveled with the armies, and his brother, William Waad, traveled and illustrated scenes from the army. And this gentleman that I'm getting to, I'm building up to, Thomas Nast. And Thomas Nast was oftentimes given the job of illustrating what would be the Christmas week cover for Harper's Weekly. And so in 1862, he started doing covers with a character who was already familiar with Americans, Santa Claus. The poem that we're familiar with, A Night Before Christmas, had already been issued. People were familiar with Santa Claus, but they weren't familiar with the image of Santa Claus as we are today. So Thomas Nast had this chore, and he came up with the image, and a lot of people credit him with establishing the Santa Claus that we know of today. For example, the one, and I was just looking at it this morning so I could describe it to you. It's absolutely gorgeous. It appeared in the January 3rd, 1863 issue of Harper's Weekly. By the way, across the top it says single copies, 6 cents. Those were the days when you could get a newspaper for 6 cents. The title of the illustration is Santa Claus in Camp. And in the foreground, Santa Claus is in his sleigh, loaded with boxes, pulled by eight reindeer. He's passing out boxes and toys to a huge crowd of soldiers gathered around him. He's dressed perhaps a little bit differently, but when you consider the military aspect of it, you'll understand he's wearing a star-spangled coat and striped pants. So basically, he's wearing Old Glory, the stars and stripes, for his jacket and pants. He's heavily bearded, like the Santa Claus we know, and wearing that very familiar cap. It's fringed in fur. Passing out toys in boxes that have come from home, and he's being cheered by the soldiers. So the soldiers are obviously happy as his arrival, and in the background you can see them waving their hands. Santa, me next. Me next.
That's clearly a northern image of Santa, though.
Yeah, but Santa Claus was also familiar in the South, and they wrote about Santa Claus.
Does Santa dress in gray in the South?
He probably was. But, of course, they're not printing images in color in those days, but in black and white. In this image, right next to the sleigh are two drummer boys, and they're being surprised by a spring-loaded jack-in-the-box jumping out of his box. Santa is showing off a puppet to the soldier that's standing next to him, and another soldier has just opened his box from home, and we'll talk about boxes from home in a moment. He's pulling out clean socks. That was a popular thing with the soldiers. In the background, we see some of them doing some of the classic Christmas Day or any kind of holiday pastimes. Soldiers are chasing a greased pig, which is a typical thing for soldiers to do. Get a pig, grease it down with axle grease they borrowed from the artillery, and then chase him around and see who can catch this pig. Presumably the guy who got the pig, he and his mess would be rewarded with the pig. Another guy is climbing a pole to retrieve some kind of prize at the top of this pole. Others are gathered around a blazing bonfire. There's another image by Thomas Nast. Christmas Eve, we see Santa with a sleigh. He's parked on top of a roof, and he's getting ready to descend the chimney. While inside, a wife with two children tucked into bed behind her, she's praying for the safety of her soldier husband. So when you think about it, a good number of the things we think about today in the 21st century were first illustrated by Thomas Nast for Harper's Weekly, and of course went out all across the North. And since newspapers were exchanged oftentimes between pickets, North and South, along the picket line or sometimes the skirmish line, some of these filtered into the South too and ran the blockade. Nast refined and reworked the image of Santa Claus continually into the 1880s for every single Christmas. And by that time, he had developed almost exactly the iconic Santa Claus that we think of today. Some of the other Christmas traditions, because a good number of them come to us thanks to the German culture and thanks to the fact that by the mid-1800s, literally hundreds and hundreds of thousands of Germans were leaving their homeland to immigrate to the United States. Thanks to the Germans, a lot of the traditions that we have today were already in existence in the Civil War. Christmas trees were being used and decorated. Typically, though, inside of a house, it was a smaller tabletop tree. And we'll talk about decorations in just a moment. People were giving gifts. Caroling was really common. There was holiday feasting. Even Christmas cards were already in existence during the Civil War. And as I mentioned, with the armies, one of the most popular things were those gifts from home, even in the Southern armies. And oftentimes, because like we talked about in the last episode, the army itself isn't issuing them enough food, the men had to rely on either the people in the neighborhood or the people at home sending them boxes to keep them hale and hearty. Here's a really famous episode from a guy by the name of Henry Kyde Douglas. Henry Kyde Douglas was on T.J. Stonewall Jackson's staff, and he was wounded at the Battle of Gettysburg and captured and spent a Christmas confined to Johnson's Island Prison in Ohio. And he wrote about what Christmas of 1863 was like. And I'm just going to read you a short paragraph. The name of his book, if you're interested in reading it, it's a great book, but a lot of his stories are exaggerated. It's I Rode with Stonewall. One of my historian friends says that he exaggerates so much that the name of the book should be Stonewall Rode with Me. But here's a paragraph about Christmas of 1863 from Henry Kyd Douglas. There came a carload of boxes for the prisoners about Christmas, which after reasonable inspection, they were allowed to receive. Remember, he's in a prisoner of war camp. My box contained more cause for merriment and speculation as to its contents than satisfaction. It had received rough treatment on its way, and a bottle of ketchup had broken and its contents very generally distributed through the box. Mince pie and fruit cake saturated with tomato ketchup was about as palatable as embalmed beef. A friend had sent a package, a bottle of old brandy on Christmas morning. I quietly called several comrades up to my bunk to taste the precious fluid of disappointment. The bottle had been opened outside by the camp guards, the brandy taken and replaced with water, adroitly recorked and sent in. I hope the Yankee who played that practical joke on me with the brandy lived to repent it.
Wow, that's quite a story. I wanted to ask you if there was any sense of Christmas in the war itself. In that, were there ceasefire or any recognition of this day between a kind of understanding between the two armies?
You know, that's a really good question, and I searched through my library and I searched online for ceasefires. There's that famous ceasefire story that took place in World War I between the trenches. As far as I can tell, there was no announced or formally made ceasefire between the Confederate and the Union armies. But I think the reason is simply this, and that is that normally for the winter season, normally the campaigning shut down anyway. So there was very little, if any, combat. There was one battle. Fredericksburg, of course, was fought in December of 1862, but that was still a couple of weeks before Christmas. There was a battle out west the last day of December and the first day of January. But aside from those larger battles, usually campaigning shut down, and so there was very little or no firing anyway between the lines, and so there wouldn't be a need for a big formal kind of ceasefire in order for both sides to celebrate Christmas. I do know, though, that sometimes between the lines, the guys would sing together. And so it's easy to imagine a situation at the Petersburg trench lines where they were separated by such a short distance, the men caroling back and forth the Christmas tunes that were popular at the time.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's an amazing story. And I guess you say they didn't campaign as heavily during
right,
the winter.
Right.
Did that mean there was a better chance that you might get a furlough around Christmas time?
Absolutely. And furloughs are what the men would dream of, a chance to go home for a short period of time and spend time with the loved ones. That happened, of course, more normally in the North. They've got, in some situations, an excess of men or enough men where they can grant furloughs. In the South, it was much, much tougher in the Southern Army to get a furlough.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, that's fantastic. Great stories, great Christmas stories.
And we want to wish everybody a Merry Christmas.
Thank you, Rick. And we will see you next time.
All right. Take care.
Join us each second and fourth Sunday for Virginia History with Rick Britton. For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.